offered with comment. Offered with comment, a half-hour program with Professors Arthur Wills and Thomas Much of the University of Alaska Department of English. Each week at this time, the hosts of Offered with Comment discuss with their guests outstanding literary selections. Now here is Professor Much.
We've asked Jerry Zaltman to return to our panel for a discussion of a work that continues the line of development we started with The Organization Man, Death of a Salesman, and Darkness at Noon. In 1948, George Orwell wrote an extended allegory of the conditions that he saw forming in the early stages of the Cold War. He reversed the last two numerals of the year and called it 1984, a world that represented the continuance for 36 years of the influences he saw then in operation. 1984 is a grim world of three gigantic socialist states kept in economic balance by the demands of continual warlike skirmishes and continual wartime austerity. Grimmer still is the harassment and control of private life in Oceania, the country that we're most concerned about, since it represents Great Britain, part of Europe, and the U.S., by the party leader, the anonymous Big Brother. Big Brother demands the same loyalty to the party that William White saw the executive demanding of the minor executive toward the company. The party dominates by its ministries and by their slogans. The Ministry of War, for instance, is called Minipax, and its slogan is War is Peace. The Ministry of Police is called Minilove, and its slogan is Freedom is Slavery. The Ministry of Propaganda, Minitrue, Ignorance is Strength. The hero sins against this particular world and its organization by thinking unconventionally, thinking outside of the party lines, and by having a love affair. His punishment forms a close parallel to Rubishov's In Darkness at Noon. Thus far, the allegory is fairly simple and fairly easy to identify. However, more than allegory, Orwell uses the book to deliver himself of opinions on a number of items that go to make up this kind of political domination. Perhaps the most interesting of these is the reform of the language into newspeak, a simplification and regularizing of the language, it is called, for the sake of efficiency. And in his appendix on newspeak, he details quite thoroughly the way in which newspeak works. However, I think perhaps a better definition of newspeak occurs in his essay of about the same time, Politics in the English Language. Here he showed how he thought that poor use of language, unimaginative use, failure to use words with discrimination to indicate shades of meaning was truly destructive to free thought and to all forms of human freedom. He wrote, "Many political words are abused. The word fascism has now no meaning, except insofar that it signifies something not desirable. The words democracy, socialism, freedom, patriotic, realistic, justice, have each of them several different meanings which cannot be reconciled with one another. In the case of a word like democracy, not only is there no agreed definition, but the attempt to make one is restricted from all sides. It is almost universally felt that when we call a country democratic, we are praising it. Consequently, defenders of every kind of regime claim that it is a democracy, and fear that they might have to stop using the word if it were tied down to any one meaning. Words of this kind are often used in a consciously dishonest way. That is, the person who uses them has his own private definition, but allows his hearers to think that he means something quite different. Statements like, Marshal Petain was a true patriot, or the Soviet press is the freest in the world, are almost always made with the intent to deceive. I think perhaps that this is a good starting point, and simply the problems that we find in terminology around us. The regime in 1984 would certainly call itself democratic, since it wants to be felt to be desirable. Do you notice any similarities to this in our own use of language now in political terminology? What do we call democratic countries?
Friends.
Friends.
Mostly. Tom, before attacking this question, I'd like to correct a statement that you made, offer a suggestion at least. I think Orwell says that 1984 is not necessarily a continuation of tendencies in the contemporary world. As a matter of fact, since you don't have any history, you never have any way of knowing what is the exact time. So 1984 may be the contemporary period. Is that your impression, Jerry?
I would tend to agree with you. Mm-hmm. I think the feeling is that he was not so much projecting current trends. He was, I think, merely projecting or developing what he feels men are capable of based upon some observations he's making at the present. Not projecting these as a historical trend, but I think developing a capacity that he feels
Things already exist in our society.
Right. Well, you have very quickly wiped away what I was hoping to bring out over about 10 minutes. I think, though, that this is very necessary, because it is so easy to look at the book and defend yourself from it by saying, well, this is sometime far in the future, and we'll certainly correct these things before we get there, or that, more specifically, the defense that I've often come across is that, well, Orwell was talking about Russia, he's not talking about what we call the free world. And it seems perfectly obvious to me that he is talking about the free world, about Great Britain and the United States specifically.
This is a universal condition he's describing, isn't it, rather than any local or national plight?
I think so. He goes as O'Brien in the last part of the book goes back to the Inquisition. And I think this is, is a recurring phenomenon, not simply in the free world or in the communist world.
Descriptive of the bad seed.
Right, yeah.
Well, I still, of course, think that there's some defense for the term extrapolation, perhaps, for this. This is a carrying out of current tendencies to a kind of logical conclusion, if only logical in the sense that it's a reductio ad absurdum, mm-hmm. of a necessary heightening. But it's always seemed to me that the world of 1984 is an extremely grim presentation of what we have around us now.
Do you think the attempt to deny objective reality is as vigorous now as Orwell describes in the work?
This gets into the, I think, this is a term I hate to use loosely, and it's existentialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this does get into the current vogue of existentialism, especially as seen in certain films, so-called New Wave films, French films, where external reality really doesn't have any definite existence, mm-hmm. no definite form.
I think, too, that Orwell based his some of his particular incidents on very concrete facts. For instance, the power split with Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia constantly combining, recombining, two against one, and those people who were our enemies last week are our friends now. I think this was very closely based upon accomplishment of the United States State Department during World War II of converting U.S. attitude toward Russia several times to accommodate Russia's realignment during World War II. Mm-hmm. It was considered to be a kind of miraculous achievement. And it did. We went from thinking of the Russians as bad to the Russians as our great friends and allies, and back to thinking of the Russians as bad old fascists again, just on the basis of the efforts of a propaganda machine.
Well, I'd like to get back to what Jerry said. Isn't it true, Jerry, that the existentialists describe reality as something dynamic and always in a state of flux? You don't have any real stasis. Reality is always particular and private mm-hmm. and individual. But in this novel, I suppose you could call it a novel. I think Tom's word for it is better. It's an allegory. Mm-hmm. Reality is treated in this manner. You don't have any fixed compartmentalizing of time ever. And yet, there is one serious difference. The existentialists would say that the way we combine experience, let's say, is pretty associational. It's a free sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And from that combination, we derive our private notions of what reality consists of. But in here, you have very strong attempt at indoctrination.
Well, I would like to cut in with just one point right here. You've been pretty esoteric and abstract in your language, Art, and I'd like to ask you, are you referring specifically to the incidents, say, in which Winston Smith, the hero, is asked to, as part of his job for the Ministry of Propaganda, go back through all newspaper items and all histories and eliminate all references to a person who has just been found out to be a traitor and been executed? This kind of tampering with history, altering it so that it continually fits the present political view.
Yeah, well, actually, that makes the existent reality always very
contemporary. I consider that this has nothing to do with existentialism. This is sheer vicious political propagandizing.
No, I think it does. Let's look at a central tenet of existentialism, and maybe I'm wrong in this, my interpretation of it, but it would go along saying something to this effect, that existence precedes essence.
That's right.
Correct?
That's one of the
assumptions. And in this story, your existence does precede your essence, because as soon as you cease to exist, your essence, in a historical sense, is wiped off. You never did exist.
You don't
history.
Have any identity. Right. Until the state shapes an identity for you.
And
this is Winston's problem. He is, in a sense, he's an apostate from all of this.
And attempting to establish his own existence, and he can only do this through the little love affair with Julia, particularly with that wonderful contrast to his ex-wife, who is always referred to there. Marital bliss as doing one's duty for the party.
But even this, Tom, does not have a great deal of freedom involved. For example, he doesn't select the girl because of any great spontaneity of attachment.
Well, after all, she is the first deviant member of the Girls' Anti-Sex League that he has found.
Yes, doesn't he say, though, that the beauty of our affair is that it represents a corruption of the police state? The personal element is almost missing altogether.
It was the act that she loved, not him so much.
Yes, and it's the symbol that he loved, that in this moment we are exercising an apostasy. If the state finds out, we will lose our heads. But in a sense, we are really challenging this. It's more of a gesture than any genuine human emotions involved, wouldn't you say?
Yes, yeah, certainly, but it's the only channel, really, that is open for any rebellion against the state. Mm-hmm. The only way in which any personal identity can be established mm-hmm. in this world, where the telescreen watches every movement and the posters of Big Brother dominate. Yet, one thing that I'd like to return to is what is the meaning of this attempt of the state to dominate so completely the people in it, why should a state insist upon this kind of loyalty in every act, in every moment? Is this a legitimate function of a state? Would Machiavelli agree with this kind of a state?
Probably, if it were effective in its operations. I think the rationale behind it is pure tyranny. Seems to me that's the only one.
Well, I find throughout the latter part, when Winston is, after he and Julia have been discovered and they are prisoners in the Ministry of Love, and he is being interrogated, I find an even worse threat involved here, that this is the kind of insanity of power. It is paranoid personality that cannot possibly tolerate any slight difference from mm-hmm. itself, and looks upon every independent act as a threat.
Mm-hmm. A self-generating system.
Yes.
Which is what White, I think, was attacking.
Yes.
And that this is actually highly descriptive of the so-called free world and the way in which both governments and businesses operate. In fact, throughout our whole culture, we find any institution tending to this.
Wouldn't you have to have this rigorous conditioning if you inverted all human values as they are inverted here? For example, war is peace. How could you possibly teach such an inversion unless you did use violent and surreptitious thought control? I don't see any way that you could do it.
And yet, hasn't it often been done for the sake of fanciful reasoning that, of course, these can be defended. They are defended within the novel, that the most stable form of peace that you can have is a continual limited war. Are we not exactly in that position right now in the world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Continual limited war is the current concept of peace.
Mm-hmm. You were alluding to a poster that you had seen before the program, Tom, and I thought it was very appropriate. Especially the enlistment posters that you see around in cities.
You'll the militarist peace is our profession.
Yes, well, here will be a rather virile, a strong, masculine man with a gun in his hand, and the caption will be, "He fights for peace." Would Orwell describe this as one of his inversions?
I think it's exactly that, and that's a sort of sloganism that he objects to, mm-hmm. and the thing that he is objecting throughout in his analysis of political language, that we no longer use words with any kind of meaning.
Yes, but isn't newspeak an abuse of simplicity?
Hmm. Oh, certainly. It's a glorious abuse when you have only the party way of thinking, and all other philosophies, all other kinds of thought can only be described under the term thought crime. Hence, they are immediately criminal, and you think of yourself as a criminal from the time you begin to have any other ideas.
I like the explanation he gives for throwing out the word bad. It is not the direct antithesis of good. In order to get that, you have to use a compound, ungood. That makes for greater precision of expression. But what does it do for the texture, the beauty, the poetry of language?
Well, it doesn't even make for more precision. It simply classes all things as either good or
ungood.
Yeah.
If you can't have a vocal expression of a feeling, then the feeling is less dangerous, I think.
Yeah, well, isn't
and that's
this
definitely what they're trying to do
the,
is to eliminate the number of ways a person can express.
Yes, and isn't that precisely what Orwell is attacking here, the either-or position in all human activities? The state here is trying to force the one response. You cannot have a dual response to anything, and it seems to me this leads to a perversion of the individual.
Well, doesn't the ultra-conservative nowadays try to impose the same kind of rigidity anyone who believes anything but a certain narrow path is un-American.
Yes.
That's interesting. I was going to bring up the instance of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which there's now a non-official body called the House, the Un-House Activities Committee. And this is a very, you know, a serious group of students, at least in the Chicago area, that have formed this committee.
Do you feel that people in our society who are intolerant of dissent are power mad, Tom, to use your expression a moment ago?
Paranoid?
the authoritarian
power
personality.
Mad. Yes. You mean like Rockwell, the leader of the American Nazi Party?
Yes.
Now, certainly we have a great many of these people. We have a number of organizations, not just the American Nazi Party, but I suppose you could certainly say this was true of the John Birch Society and of a great many other groups, all of whom seek to limit the ability of anyone to think in any slightly different pattern from their own. In other words, they use no definable set of meanings for terms such as communist, socialist, bad, illegal, un-American. They simply class under these terms anything that is different from what they themselves believe. They cannot conceive of anyone being any good, possibly, if he differs one slight bit.
I once heard a marvelous caricature of their position. It went something like this: I will defend your right to death. I will defend your right to say something to death. But if you say it, I'll knock you down.
This then would be the true American position, or if you want to call it that, the true human position, that we people the right to hold their own opinions. We would defend the right to of someone to disagree with us.
Well, a free society actually presupposes dissent, doesn't it? Once you take that away,
it's dissent up to the other fellow's nose. And the problem is that the other fellow's nose has been getting longer and longer, at least as far as the other fellow is concerned. And that's the problem.
Jerry, what leads to the desire, you think, on the part of such people to abolish the past?
To abolish the past?
There's a general attempt here at an abolition of all history.
To the extent that history, particularly the immediate past, if this is a new phenomenon, the history represents a different, very different way of handling things, such as here. Things were very different when the old fellow in the bar was a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
Things were very different when lemons existed. Now they don't remember lemons and good old-fashioned chocolate.
Yeah.
And these are very dangerous memories, particularly at this state where the language hasn't been reduced to a very simple
actually
basis.
isn't it a rejection of all concepts of objective reality, a kind of existentialism in itself, a denial of any objective reality, because objective reality in itself presupposes that there might be some phenomena that don't agree with your subjective version.
The ultimate truth is penultimately false.
that's it exactly. The interrogation of Winston here is very successfully done, I think, in terms of the ruthless extent that the party will go in reducing a man to the level of
two
acquiescence.
Yeah, I'd like to bring up a point in just a few minutes left, but it's connected with this interrogation. It's very similar to the interrogation of Darkness at Noon.
Yes.
Whereupon Rubashov discovers the grammatical I, which is the very pronoun that's trying to be crushed in this book. And similar also to Ayn Rand's Anthem, as I recall, the discovery of the word
I.
And I wonder if you, either of you, feel that this is something that is very prevalent in society today, particularly in this country.
The tendency to groupthink?
To groupthink, to non-I think, and so forth.
I think
you answered the question the way you
it's a loaded question.
In the light of our previous comments,
what is the purpose of the modern executive technique of never letting one man decide anything, but always turning it into a committee, of always trying to the team approach to a problem rather than allowing any individual a chance to think, to solve a problem, to make a decision, and thus establish his identity as an individual.
Yes, and doesn't this prevailing condition lead to some rather adolescent and infantile rebellions? People are rebelling rather thoughtlessly. They really don't have anything to attack, so they end up just attacking in a somewhat indiscriminate way.
Yes, that's I think the fault in such a repressive system that rebellion is not constructive, it's merely destructive. It's like a small child throwing a tantrum rather than any mature consideration of what a better alternative would be.
I suppose the individual is ultimately forced to the position of defending what he thinks is his individual integrity.
I'd like to insert here, though, the fact that something that we've forgotten to consider. This is a novel. It is an imaginative work of literature. Yet, I think our entire discussion has showed that it's a piece of political propaganda, an attempt to change people's minds. And this, I think, is one important function of the novel and of any art of writing that often gets overlooked. The fact that the imaginative, the fictional approach is often one of the strongest. This is the reason that leads, the thing that leads me particularly to admire Orwell as a writer. He is not afraid to use the novel for this purpose, and he goes ahead and uses it, I think, rather well. In his own essay, Why I Write, he describes one of the main purposes in writing as political purpose, the desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's lives, other people's idea of the kind of society they should strive after. Once again, he says, no book is genuinely free from political bias. Even the opinion that art should have nothing to do with politics is in itself a political attitude.
You've been listening to Offered with Comment. Offered with Comment is produced and moderated by Professors Arthur Wills and Thomas Mutz. Today's guest was Gerald Zaltman. The subject of next week's program will be Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare. Offered with Comment was directed by Don Wheeler and originated in the studios of KUAC on the campus at College. This is the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service.